here to give a seminar and collaborate. Okay, so I'd like to talk about a few different issues that are involved in this strange thing. Is this serious? Or about some different things in our sort of understanding of dark energy, which may or may not turn out to be important. So let me just begin by kind of going back to the beginning of where our sort of evidence for dark energy comes from. So there was sort of evidence for a cosmological constant from Kolbe plus age constraints, which didn't really sort of materialize until supernova were observed and confirmed that there was a problem with a Friedman model without a cosmological constant. So this came when we looked at the distance modulus, the magnitude of supernova, were all far too dim. So on a picture like this, they're all above a line such as this Einstein de Sitter model. So they were too dim to be described by an Einstein de Sitter universe or a universe with curvature. And today we have a sort of concordance of observations coming together on this model where we have in parameter space the matter density, the dark matter density, and the cosmological constant. We have a sort of fairly small ellipse where all the different observations overlie each other. And this gives us a very nice framework to work with in cosmology. So to some extent, cosmology is just the subject of narrowing down these error ellipses and making them smaller and smaller as time goes on. And we have a flat lambda CDM model as our model for cosmology. But there's a few problems with this model, mainly in of course, the dark energy interpretation. We know that lambda doesn't make any sense as vacuum energy, with the predicted value for the vacuum energy being about 120 orders of magnitude off the theoretical estimate. There's an important coincidence problem associated with the cosmological constant. In particular, we happen to live in a universe in which observers such as ourselves exist when the vacuum energy density and the matter density are about the same size. So one way to think about this is that the dark energy density and the matter energy density, if we take the ratio like this, and this grows like the volume of the universe, and we happen to live at a time when this is of order one. So in fact, in the space of the cosmological constant, if you pick a value at random, it's about as large as it could be for life to exist at all. So perhaps some landscape arguments can answer this. I put one day there, but then maybe here that's not such a good idea. So maybe landscape arguments have already answered this. If there are 10 to the 500 universes which we're supposed to think about as actual physically existing, then we have a strange Copernican-type problem where we happen to live in a very special subset of those universes. Okay, so yes, no, I agree. Yeah, so there's a problem with the naive calculation. I don't know if anybody can calculate it more accurately, so there's definitely an issue there that is probably where the resolution, to be honest, with dark energy will lie, but nevertheless. So one way actually to see this this coincidence problem is if we take a plot. This one's stolen from this guy's thesis. It was on the web a few days ago, and we plot the history of the universe on a logarithmic scale. Then we can see there are some phase transitions where we go from an inflationary era to a radiation era, then a matter-dominated era, and a lambda-dominated era in the future. We happen to live in a particular universe where this lambda domination happens today when we exist. So we live right in the middle of this sort of phase transition, if you like. Okay, so if the acceleration isn't a cosmological constant, there's been plenty of suggestions. One is that there's some sort of genuine dark energy that exists, some sort of quintessence field, which we'd all like to find in a lab. The other suggestion is that gravity is wrong on Hubble scale, so on In the infrared, there's something wrong with it with general relativity. Perhaps it gets weaker on large scales, and so explains the dimming of the supernova in that way. There's been some speculation that we're not taking into account the back reaction of structure properly. We're not defining our Friedmann models correctly. I'll talk about this a bit later. And there's also another, perhaps even stranger suggestion, that we live in the center of a huge Hubble-scale depression in the matter density, and that there's something actually wrong with the Copernican assumption that we use at the heart of cosmology. So I'd like to talk about these last two mainly today, and just have a chat about these different kinds of ideas. Okay, so just an outline of what I'm going to talk about. I'll talk briefly about how we go about observing lambda and how we look for deviations from lambda CDM in the data. Then I'd like to talk about this back reaction problem, or the averaging problem in cosmology, of how we actually define the Friedmann models in the first place, given that we live in a lumpy space-time, basically. And then I'd like to examine the idea that we could actually be living in a very inhomogeneous universe, and that perhaps there's something wrong with the Copernican principle at the heart of cosmology. Okay, so sorry about all the equations. This is just to orient everybody. So you can ignore basically all the equations. I'll point out the important bits. Here we have our Hubble rate, which we apparently measure to be accelerating. And the factor responsible is this dark energy equation of state, which is the pressure divided by the energy density. And much of the game in dark energy cosmology is to try and determine what this function, as a function of redshift, is. Okay, so we need to do that through observations. We measure the luminosity distance, which consists of an integral of the Hubble rate, which is an integral of the dark energy equation state. So there's two integrations involved. If we turn that round, we want, this is W of Z here, we need to differentiate this luminosity distance data twice to get to the equation of state W. So we can see there's two derivatives required of the data to find out what W is. So quite a tricky, tricky thing to do. And what we're trying to observe is deviations from W equals minus 1, which is the cosmological constant. So if I can just show you how awkward that is, here is a function of redshift. On the left, I've taken the ratio of the luminosity distance of some just random made-up models to the luminosity distance of the canonical lambda CDM model. And here I've plotted some models which differ from lambda CDM by less than a percent. So all these fluctuations are less than a percent in the distance data. When we reconstruct the Hubble rate as a function of redshift compared to lambda CDM, these get amplified to a 5% change from lambda CDM in the Hubble rate as a function of redshift. And then when we try and characterize that as the effective equation of state W, we have an order of one change. So minus one is the canonical lambda CDM value. If we take this green curve here, say, we can see that's fluctuating by a factor of order one. And yet that gives you a sub-percent change to the distance modulus. So I'm not saying any of these have anything to do with reality, but it gives us an idea of how difficult it is to extract from distance data anything about the equation of state. Okay. Oops. There are some problems that come in further from this is, of course, that we have other parameters to measure in cosmology, an important one being the curvature. It's sort of taken for granted in cosmology that the curvature is zero, pretty much. So we often say that it's measured to be zero, but there's an important degeneracy with dark energy that comes from curvature. If we take one of these curves here as a function of redshift, I've plotted an effective equation of state that one might infer from assuming we live in a flat universe if we live in actually a curved one. So let's say the curvature is 5% here, this one here, say, and we assume we live in a flat universe. Then we would mistakenly reconstruct an evolving dark energy model by mistake from this assumption. So these degeneracies are important if we allow dark energy to evolve. And so constraints on the curvature, here's from the WMAP5 paper where they get the error on curvature down to a couple of percent or so. It should be remembered that these constraints depend on our assumption of lambda quite strongly. So even when W is freed up to be just some arbitrary constant, a little bit dubious what it means, the constraint still depends strongly on this assumption. So it's very difficult to say just the flatness part of the flat lambda CDM on its own is actually the case, given that we don't know what dark energy is. If you're happy with lambda, then the constraints are fine. But if you're not, then there are some additional problems. Okay, so excuse me. These strong constraints on curvature rely on our assumptions about dark energy. So one question then is can we look for deviations from flat lambda CDM? Are there perhaps observational signatures we can look for? Well, there's some model-independent consistency tests we can do with distance data. So here's an example of one, where if we take distance data d and differentiate it once, stick it into this formula, we get a number which should be constant. That number is the matter density today. And because this is constant for flat lambda CDM, it gives us a consistency test we can do on the data in order to sort of check that we're doing the right thing. Another way to look at this formula is that this function here, which involves second derivatives of the data, just like W, should be zero for any flat lambda CDM model, irrespective of the other parameters of the model. So these are potentially useful consistency tests. And here's an example of it in motion, where the supernova data here, these crosses, are smoothed over in a model-independent way and inverted to give us this function omega m. We can see there's very slight evidence for deviation here. All of these curves are a better fit than lambda CDM for the supernova data, but nevertheless, the lambda CDM fits the supernova data quite well. But it gives us a way of measuring deviations from lambda CDM without having to worry about other parameters. Okay, so there's no dependence on parameters, and one can construct more complicated tests as well. So I would argue that these are sort of sensible ways to look at things in the light of our lack of knowledge of dark energy. Okay, so
those Qs were
so these curves are all fit to the data, and each of those curves fit to data better than lambda CDM. So we take the data and we smooth it in a sort of fairly sort of simplistic fashion, and then each of those curves, because we don't really have any argument for any of the curves over any of the other ones, if we're doing things in a model-independent way, one can just say, well, these fit the data, so this gives you some indication. Okay, so so the idea is to try and constrain deviations from flat lambda CDM in a model-independent way, rather than assuming a model and fitting that to data.
Of the curves that you choose to fit, where they.
Oh, I see. So it's just it's a smoothing method where the data is taken with a I think it's a Gaussian window function, and it's smoothed over them with a particular width. Yeah. So I mean, there's arbitrariness when it comes to doing this, but these curves still fit better than lambda CDM, although probably in a meaningless way in light of the fact there's not that many supernova. Yeah.
Here is that there are two different ways of reducing the supernova data, that it gives results that are different.
And yeah, the SOP and the Henotsius.
Yeah, and do you have that here?
No, we haven't proposed to include that sort of thing. Yeah.
I just wonder how
to get
different.
What does that make?
Yeah, I'm not sure to be honest. Yeah, so this is just the standard constitution data we use.
Okay. All right, so I'd like to talk now about this back reaction averaging problem, so jumping aside a little bit. This is something that has been around for a while and is still, I think, not really answered, as to how the structure in the universe affects the background model. So I'll explain it in different ways, but just to give you an idea of... Oh, that looks pretty bad. So just to give you an idea, this is a part of the Millennium simulation. And I don't know if you can see here, but there's some boxes here which are in black and white. Do they come out clearly? Yeah? These boxes are about 100 megaparsecs across. And this is a scale at which the universe is supposed to be homogeneous, in 100 megaparsec boxes, roughly speaking. They're supposed to contain about the same amount of matter. And we can see that there's quite a lot of structure, even in these boxes. So you can see that the scale of sort of filaments and big lumps and so on
are not too far off that kind of characteristic homogeneity scale. So there's been a lot of speculation that actually what we're doing when we construct the Freeman models is not taking this into account properly in some unknown, unspecified way yet. So what we want to do is take the real structure and smooth it to produce a background which has no structure in it. So the normal Friedman models are those models. So one way that we do this is in sort of standard perturbation theory for cosmology. What we do is we compute everything in a series expansion around an assumed background. So we try and model a real space-time with a metric, G bar, and we do that by taking a background Friedman model which is usually flat. And this is the model that we fit to background observables, such as a supernova. And then we add on perturbations at first order and second order. And one can carry on until you lose the will to live. But the question is how these higher order perturbations, I guess, fit into this part of the calculation, this part of the cosmology, where we fit all the observables to, all the background observables. So one would imagine, because these are perturbations, it should be small. But there's been some debate about whether this is actually real. And the reason is that mathematically, we don't know how to average the field equations. It doesn't make sense because they're tensor equations. We can't average tensors in a covariant way. Another problem is the field equations are nonlinear. So if you average a geometry at a given time and then evolve it, it doesn't stay, that those two space-times don't stay close to each other. So time evolution and averaging don't commute. So this is another issue. So it's just, in some sense, it's a maths problem. Another way to think about it in terms of cosmology, if we think about cosmology from a sort of standard inflationary point of view, where we have logarithm of time along the x-axis, and scale, logarithm of scale along the y-axis, then we have our inflationary era, radiation era, and the matter era. Modes leaving the horizon during inflation and then re-entering and so on and giving structure at late times on small scales. Then the way cosmology works is to put down a model initially during inflation, and that model has a curvature and a cosmological constant. And those are kind of fixed constants of nature, if you like, for all time. And then we try and deduce from observations here what those constants were during inflation, very early on. Okay, but the averaging problem gives us corrections at this stage, at late times, giving us a different effective curvature and perhaps an effective cosmological constant, or a change to the effective cosmological constant. Okay, so the question, if one doesn't think that this is dark energy, there's still a question to be answered of how those background parts, how these the averaging corrections are removed to get to what we think is a flat Friedman model with a particular value of lambda, which is set down in the initial conditions, if you like. Okay, so there's been some debate in the literature. Bucher has been banging on about this for years and years, saying that this is an important problem. And some work by Kolb et al. Have said that the corrections are much more than 10 to the minus 5, and it's an order 1 correction to the standard model. Some other people have been a bit more circumspect. So Lee and Schwartz have said, well, the corrections are at most a few percent. And then more recently, Bauman et al. Have said, no, the corrections are very small. And in fact, one could even argue that the correction should be 10 to the minus 10, because the first order part of the calculation actually doesn't contribute to the back reaction. So it should be, in the standard picture, it should be a tiny effect. But there's been this debate in the literature. One can ask, say, well, do we care? I mean, cosmology is obviously just flat lambda CDM. But there's problems if we're looking into dark energy properly, because there's a degeneracy involved in this issue. So the averaging parts enter the Rey-Chaudhuri equation, which is where we measure the accelerating expansion from. So if we're going to do, at the very least, precision cosmology, we need to understand this effect and work out how to remove it at all. So
here's how the issue works. So let's say we take some scalar, psi, space-time scalar, and we want to say what its average value is in a given domain. Say, what's the average energy density over a scale of 100 megaparsecs? Yeah.
Usually in perturbation theory, we as you said, you have zeroth order, first order, second
yeah.
order.
Yeah.
But then what you do is that you actually work out the values of first order and second order. And yeah. if they are small,
yeah.
then you say that as zeroth order result is correct,
yeah.
so you don't care about the higher order terms.
Yeah.
So, but have we demonstrated that breaks down? I mean, instead of trying to do the average. So the averaging, had this not happened, had the second order term become big, then you would maybe want to go and try to do an averaging. But if you already know that the perturbation theory hasn't broken down, that all those terms are tiny, then why would you want to do?
Well, I mean, that's a fair argument. Yeah, that's a fair argument. But, I mean, at the same time, you've got small changes to your metric, but you've also got order one changes to your density fluctuation,
yeah.
even within perturbation theory. So
yeah.
there's order one fluctuations coming in at the matter tensor side, small perturbations to your metric, and somewhere in the middle those things join up, and who knows
yeah.
what the real...
But the matter side, and that's two simulations, mm-hmm. and I guess simulations that you showed, they include all the nonlinearities in matter. I mean,
well, they're doing Newtonian. I mean, this is a relativistic effect, I think. In Newtonian physics, this isn't an issue.
But those are the terms that are. Oh, because so nonlinear Newtonian terms are included in simulations.
Yeah.
Nonlinear relativistic terms
yeah.
are the ones that are attempted minus pi.
So this is a speculation that these could add up to.
Mm-hmm.
When you integrate over a large enough volume, these could add up to give you a systematic shift, which could be big.
Yeah. And if they are a small point by point, how could they be big?
Well,
yeah.
I guess no. Anyway, it depends. If you're looking at a function which is always small, if it's always
mm-hmm.
above the x-axis, then it can give you a big effect. Even if it's
if you're
just looking at a function which is always small,
yeah,
then it could add up to a big effect because. If you
take
yeah.
an integral,
yeah.
but if this is a deviation from Friedman, from
yeah.
unperturbed background
yeah.
Friedman, if the deviation from it is a small, then it's a small. That's
well, it's. I mean, the deviations in the metric are small.
Yeah.
Point by point.
That's right.
But that doesn't mean that the deviations for the whole space time are small, because
yeah.
you measure the dynamics of the metric, which are through the connection,
mm-hmm.
And through the curvature. And those need to be small because your matter densities are order one, basically.
So, by the way, how do you take into account that you have black holes somewhere?
Yeah, I was just ignoring that. Sarafa.
I just wondered, are some of these things you're saying related to speculations by, for example, Robert Brandenburger and Richard Wooder, and I think Emil Mottola, maybe? There's some people who have talked about a back reaction.
Right,
very large sort of infrared scale
yeah.
influencing the effect of lambda. Is that connected to this, or is that something different?
It is, I think, to be honest, I haven't studied their stuff in enough detail to answer you properly, but it is related to this issue. I think somebody else might answer
that
better than me.
This is purely classical.
Yes,
there
is purely classical.
Yeah.
As I understand it.
That's the difference. This is ultraviolet, that's infrared. So
yeah. This is ultraviolet.
Robert was mostly focused on infrared, the ones which are outside the horizon.
Yes.
Yeah,
so
they say, how do we know that, given that we have all the matter structure, the total metric is still Friedman?
So this is your ground is ultraviolet.
Yeah, most of the effect comes from the UV for this stuff. There is an infrared part to worry about as well.
Inside the horizon.
UV means anything inside the horizon.
Yeah.
Inside the horizon.
Yeah, that's small scale.
People is the word.
Yeah, we don't care about anything inside the horizon.
So this is the kind of the arguments involved. So let me just define how it kind of works. So once you've got a Riemannian geometry, to take a spatial average over a domain, you need to perform a Riemannian integral, and that means that you have to choose a spatial hypersurface, which isn't particularly well defined, and you also have determinants of your metric coming into the integrals you have to do. So if you're wanting to try and work out how big this is, it's a bit awkward because you need to know what the exact space-time is here to calculate these averages. So that's a little bit of an awkward problem. But one way to do it is to do it perturbatively, you know, order by order. One can have a go at calculating these things and just see if they're large within perturbation theory. I think that's a reasonable thing to do within the concordance model. So let me just go through quickly perturbation theory to second order. So we write down the metric in a particular gauge and expand the bits of interest to second order. So here we use the Poisson gauge and expand up to second order in those variables. The first order solution at late times is nice and easy, phi equals psi. And we have an evolution equation for the perturbation variable phi, the gravitational potential, which doesn't depend on scale. So all the perturbations evolve at the same rate. They just decay when the cosmological constant kicks in. And we have a power spectrum today, which depends on a transfer function, which is where all the physics of the early universe is contained, and this g of z, which tells us how the density fluctuations decay as the cosmological constant kicks in. So reasonably straightforward first order. So when we calculate the average of a quantity like the expansion rate up to second order, we get a ridiculous-looking expression. So we calculate HD here is the average of the expansion rate over a given domain D. So here we have the background Hubble rate, which is put in the model to begin with. And then we have some first-order contributions where these average brackets now refer to a Euclidean average, and we've expanded out in the integrals all the relativistic terms order by order. So we have these first order terms, and then all the rest is second order, and then we have some pure second order terms which can be solved for and expressed in terms of first order contributions squared. Okay, so we have something that can be worked out. It looks ridiculous, but when we take an ensemble average of this, we can have a go at drawing pictures of it to see how big the effect is. So the change to the Hubble rate is comfortingly small. When we take the Friedmann equation, take the ensemble average of it, and then take the square root, we get a change to the Hubble rate, which you can't even really see on this picture. This red line here is the averaged Hubble rate divided by background Hubble rate. And you can see there's a little bit here, very small effect, less than 0.1%. The variance is potentially interesting that we've sketched here with these sort of error bars, if you like. And as a function of redshift, this effect grows to a maximum, which is not particularly exciting, and then starts to decay when lambda kicks in. The important point to look at here is this equality scale domain. Here we've chosen the domain of averaging to be the what's supposed to be about the homogeneity scale. 100 megaparsecs or so. So, yeah.
You call 100 megaparsec the homogeneity scale?
Well, that's roughly the sort of standard rule of thumb, roughly speaking.
But the correlation function, the correlation length is 10 megaparsec.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what's the significance.
Right. Okay. So I mean, you could say even smaller than that if you want. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, well, actually, yeah, you're right. So the scale in perturbation theory is the equality scale, which is your BAO bump and so on. So, as far as I know, there's some debate in the literature exactly where the homogeneity scale is. But you're right that 10 megaparsecs is where the...
So that's
where the 10 megaparsecs thing comes from.
Right.
Okay. So that's a scale. That's a scale that comes into the actual perturbation theory. So if we have a go at changing this scale, so if we concentrate on this bottom left picture here, this RD is a domain size where you're taking a ball and averaging over it and seeing what the expansion rate is. Again, the actual change to the mean is very small, but the variance becomes quite big. So if we're looking at averaging on scales of 30 megaparsecs, then we're getting a variance of about a couple of a percent, which is potentially important for precision measurements of H naught. It's certainly not enough to influence dark energy measurements, at least naively looking at this picture. Okay. But then some interesting stuff happens when we try and calculate the deceleration parameter, the time derivative of the Hubble rate. So the deceleration parameter is defined through the second derivative time derivative of the scale factor. And it's the same kind of formula as before, but it now includes terms like this, which actually have a UV divergence in them. So suddenly the problem goes from being quite small to effectively unquantifiable. So that's what the expression looks like. So here when we actually calculate it, it's a little bit difficult to know exactly what to do because we've got this UV divergence. So one way we thought to do it was to smooth over the perturbations on a scale where we think perturbation theory might be breaking down and the equations are being a bit useless. So one way to do that is to choose a non-linearity scale.
Two slides. This one. Yeah, that's right. So I don't quite understand. So you're saying you get the Hubble constant and deviation from lambda c to the small, and then somehow when you take the derivative of the Hubble constant, that doesn't make sense. I mean, one is just the derivative of the other one.
It's this problem. It's exactly the problem of the averaging problem, is that the time evolution and the spatial averaging don't commute.
So I'm not saying that this is the right answer. I'm saying this is what you get if you calculate it.
You can take the derivative here and then the time average, not the other way.
Yeah, so when you take the time derivative, you then have to commute with the spatial averaging, and that brings in these divergent terms here, which
how do you know which one is the right thing to...
Well, you get the same answer whichever way you try and calculate it.
But you just said the two don't commute with each other. So.
Oh, I see, right. So that's when we take the time derivative of the scale factor here. All right, so when you actually get it to calculate in terms of the metric quantities, you always have to use this commutation relation.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm not saying that this is the sort of final answer to the problem, but I'm saying it's there as an issue.
Yeah.
Locally defined expansion rate, is that right?
Yes.
Averaged over some...
Yeah, that's right. So it's locally defined and averaged over some ball of the size of your choice.
When you're showing the fluctuations, that's just at one point. So, it represents only one region. It's not an average over the whole.
Yeah, that's right. So we take an average over a ball,
and then we take an ensemble average over lots of balls, and that's how we get these plots basically. Yeah. So the plots plus a variance to it.
So
how does one know if the fluctuations are a gauge effect or?
Well, that's right. So it's not done, basically. So there's a gauge invariant way of doing this, which we're exploring, which is a bit of a nightmare. But even then, you have to choose a hypersurface and all that sort of thing. So I'm not saying that this is the answer that one should put into one's code. I'm just saying that it's an issue, which is not quantifiable because of those divergent terms. To give you an idea, what we've done here, we've chosen this smoothing scale RS, which is basically where we stop our integrals in K space at the silk scale, which is about 10 megaparsecs, 11 megaparsecs. Again, we've taken a quality scale domain. And if we look at this picture here for the concordance model, the dotted line here is the background value, and we can see there's about a 10% change to the value of Q of Z. So that's heavily dependent on the smoothing scale, and in fact there's a UV divergence. So really we don't know what the answer is. It's not quantifiable within perturbation theory would be the way I would argue that.
So it's a sorry?
But H itself is not diverted. It wasn't very different. It was only less than 1%.
Right. Yeah.
But so the derivative,
it's ridiculous. You're right. So so I mean the point is that these extra terms come in, which are d squared phi squared, which diverge in the UV.
So if you want to calculate time rate of change of your Hubble rate, these terms need to be regulated somehow. And this is basically the sort of, you know, the simplest handle turning way of doing it. And yet they still appear. So there's probably a way to make them disappear. And I would say that would be a nice thing to show. Yeah, so that would be an elegant way to do it.
Right.
You took it seriously.
So let me rephrase, I guess, the question. So the distances are what you're interested in on the metric, right?
Yeah.
And those are an integral over h.
Yeah.
Not q, not the deceleration parameter. So those supposedly are not affected.
Right, yeah. So that's presumably true? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Not yet.
Not yet, Sean. That's right.
We've got h, and h doesn't change very much.
Yeah, so again, it's not clear how this actually relates to real observations. Because this is a spatial average, which in and of itself is a bit of a meaningless thing to do, perhaps. I don't know. So our argument was to take all the different results in the literature and compute our own one, which just messes up the whole thing even more. So we just did the standard thing in perturbation theory, which is to calculate these things, and this is what you get. So there'll be ways to make it go away, perhaps, but I would argue that at the moment it's still an issue. So just to conclude the background part of the talk, the background model is renormalized
that you start with because of structure, but we don't know how much and in what way. So that was a lot of work for not very much. But it could be a 10% effect or more. The way we cut off our integrals is extremely conservative. The Silt scale is quite a big scale in order to where we cut off the integrals. And so this is a potentially important effect, I would say, if we're trying to quantify Q and W. Okay, so the last thing I would like to talk about is a possibility that dark energy doesn't exist at all, and that it's actually a consequence of large-scale inhomogeneity in the curvature and matter density in the universe. So let's just have a look at why this could work in the first place. All right. So if we're looking out in space, generally speaking, to think about dark energy, we're trying to find out about time evolution of the universe, but we're observing the universe from one particular point, which means that's extremely difficult to distinguish from radial variation in stuff that we look at. So based on this, one can construct models which are spherically symmetric, which can fit distance data to any Friedman model you like, basically. So one can reinterpret lambda as a change in matter density as we go away from us. So the first models to do this were by John, where he postulated, before dark energy was even found, postulated a change in the matter density omega, where it changes from about 0.2 to 1 at large redshift. Okay, so with this, one can actually get quite a good fit to the supernova data.
When was the first
one? This was 95.
95.
So, yeah. 94. But, yeah.
I was 16 years younger.
So this was participating in the supernova data? Or?
Yes. I've seen the paper.
Okay.
So, yeah, amazing.
So this is how they kind of work. So here's an example by Alnez et al., where they take, again, the distance modular, supernova data, all these dots, and the red curve, the red dotted curve, is the canonical lambda CDM model, and here's an inhomogeneous model, which also fits data. There have been some attempts to kind of come up with different ways to do this. Here's an onion-shaped model, which I think is probably ruled out by now, but it gives you an idea
of what's going on. Again, the green curve is lambda CDM. And what they've done here is that they've taken different shells of different density around us and fitted the supernova using that. And you can see that gives you wiggles in the distance modulus, which actually provide a fairly decent fit to the supernova data. So since this has come out, there's been more supernova data in this region, which has ruled out such crazy behavior. Here's another modification of it with just one shell around us at a redshift of about 0.1. So you get the idea. So there's lots of different ways to do this. There's a different type of inhomogeneous model, and so on.
Lambda CDM, luminosity distance with an homogeneous model.
Yeah.
Precisely. I mean,
you can do it exactly.
Exactly. In principle,
yeah.
I mean, just
yeah. So with distance database, you can't ever say one or the other effectively. But having said that, the models which produce a lambda CDM distance modulus exactly have to be very steep voids, steep in their radial profile, and they actually have to be quite sharp and centered. So in principle, that gives you a way of saying that they're ridiculous. We're going to go at
looking at some sort of Gaussian profile. So this is a void profile for omega matter, if you like, with an accompanying curvature change and an accompanying Hubble rate from the center to far away. So you can see that a lower matter density rising up to about 0.7 to 1 gives you a distance modulus with a fraction of a percent difference from lambda CDN. So indistinguishable using distance data, basically. So these are all good fits to the data, these types of void models. And they fit age data quite nicely. one thing that's it's a little bit new if maybe you haven't seen these before, but one can age date luminous red galaxies, roughly. And people have been starting to look at this. It's probably quite a powerful test in about 10 or 20 years, but one can reconstruct H of Z without having to worry about distances doing this, and that's quite a nice technique. So these also fit the data available, of which there's about 9 data points, so not particularly exciting, but nevertheless, this gives a potential way of ruling out these sort of models where the dotted line here is a sort of standard lambda CDM, and all of these curves are void models which fit the data quite well. Okay. So the age dating of galaxies. Oh, God. Okay, so with luminous red galaxies, basically all the stars, so it's assumed that they have the same kind of evolution. All the stars are basically dead, so they're just cooling down over time. So the idea is that one can then calculate an actual age for each galaxy that you see based on basically its color. So the error bars are big on this, right? It's a new technique, and it's, you know, got quite a lot of assumptions in it. But well, actually, you get the relative ages between galaxies, I think, as you go from one to the next, and that gives you dt by dz, which translates into a Hubble rate at each redshift. Yeah, that's right.
Voids and lambda CDM.
Yeah.
Well, as you say, how serious is that difference?
Oh, well, there's only like 8 or 9 data points. So.
Well, I know, but I mean,
yeah.
Eventually we've got 50 data points. How serious is the deviation?
Right, so one can construct voids
to fit both the distance modulus and this, but, you know, if you're coming up with an inhomogeneous model which has to fit 2 functions that reproduce lambda CDM, then it's getting pretty ridiculous. If you've got a void with a density profile which gives you a similar distance modulus and, you know, a distinguishable H of Z, then that's, I think, a fair contender.
Yeah.
I would say using H of Z.
So the void model tends to give a younger universe, right? In general.
Right, so it depends on your parameters, but it gives the same age as a Friedman model with the same parameters along each whirl line. So along, say, the central whirl line with an H naught, an omega matter, and an omega curvature, you get the same range as a Friedmann model. In fact, one way to think about them is that each shell evolves as a separate Friedmann universe. Okay, so there's no communication between whirl lines in the dust model. Okay, so all the Friedmann intuition that you have goes through. There's one aspect of them that they can have a varying bang time. So the Big Bang didn't have to happen simultaneously in these models. So that can give you then different ages, depending on how that thing is chosen. I haven't considered that in anything I'm showing here, but it does exist as a possible thing. Okay, let me just... Yes. So for these best fit models, one can have a look at the effective deceleration parameter. I'm just showing this quickly. This is dotted line is lambda CDM. The voids then suddenly have a big difference in the effective deceleration parameter. And the reason I show this is because there was a recent paper by Scheifele et al. Where they actually were looking for evolving dark energy, and they found the same upturn in the supernova at low redshift. So for different dark energy models, they found for Q of Z, there's an upturn at around Z equals zero, so the same sort of thing we found for void models when we calculate this thing effectively. So the supernova gives you some indication, perhaps, that there's something going on at a redshift of zero, which doesn't quite fit with lambda CDM, but it's probably not significant at the moment. Okay, let me skip that. Okay, so how else do these void models work? Well, they can fit the CMB for a central observer. so this is something that's been shown quite recently. So for large L, so for small scales, the CMB calculation is quite easy. This part here, for low L, large scales, the calculation hasn't been performed. It's quite complicated. But you can see that you can make up, so the same void model which fits the supernova data also fits the lambda CDM CMB wiggles. So there's no way really to tell the difference between these models using the CMB on small scales. Okay, so that's perhaps a surprising result. But it's because the CMB really constrains local physics, and the local physics before decoupling aren't really affected by large-scale inhomogeneity. So something we did just recently was have a look at the lithium problem. So the lithium problem is an ongoing problem in the standard model with BBN and something like that. But it's anywhere between a 2.5 to 5 sigma discrepancy in the standard model. The problem is that the lithium abundances which are measured don't agree or don't give you a baryon-photon ratio the same as what we measure from the CMB. So the key issue really is that we measure the baryon-photon ratio, which tells us how fast BBN happened. We measure that through local stars, which is where lithium is measured. We measure it through galaxies at redshift about 3 through deuterium measurements, and we measure it from the CMB. And the lithium doesn't agree with the other measurements by a factor of about 1.5 to 2, but it's over the years this has become a more and more kind of awkward problem. Nobody knows how to solve it. But if we just have a think about where the data come from, the data for the lithium come from local observations, which means that probes BBN along our past world line at very early times in the universe. The CMB measurements probe at a redshift of about 1,000, which is a very long way away from us, 15 gigaparsecs away from us. So if there's a radial inhomogeneity in this parameter eta, which is the baryon-photon ratio, one needn't expect those numbers to match up. Okay. So it seems a bit of a far-fetched idea, but it's possible that these measurements, the lithium measurements, which are a rare glimpse of our past world line very early on in the evolution of the universe, are telling us something about the homogeneity at that time. So remember that the horizon size during BBN is of order parsecs or kiloparsecs at most, whereas
the scale of this on inhomogeneity is gigaparsecs. It's much, much bigger. Okay. Yeah.
Temperature preservation.
Yeah.
That's right. So you have, this is completely independent of what gives you apparent acceleration.
Right. So not quite, because the
isocurvature perturbations can evolve into a curvature once the modes enter. So they're not.
Right, so that when you put in radiation, there's quite a lot of freedom, actually.
Yeah.
So you've got the matter, so you've got the curvature locally and asymptotically,
yeah.
And you've got the relative radiation density, mm-hmm. density locally and asymptotically.
So that's two free functions.
Right? Effectively, yeah. Yeah. But I don't think this doesn't work in a freedom model. So this gives you quite a large inhomogeneity at decoupling time if one tries to do it in a constant curvature model. Mm-hmm. So you need something inhomogeneous on gigaparsec
scales
late times to make it work. Yeah.
Can you just run over that again? So lithium, you say, comes from local observations?
Yeah, so it's from local galactic observations.
The deuterium does not?
So it does, but it's got huge errors on it.
Oh.
Plus there's an unknown depletion from star formation, so it's not well quantified from deuterium.
And helium,
it's the same story. It's big.
So why do people say that it fits the BVM model well?
So they all agree with this value eta equals 6,
except for lithium, which is down here about 4, 3 or 4, but the error bars for helium and deuterium, you know, they're up here and down to here at 1 sigma, so the errors are quite big, but they all agree. That's right. You see what I mean? But the errors for...
It doesn't disagree.
It doesn't disagree.
so that's right. So it's only lithium that disagrees with the others.
I mean, only lithium is well measured, and it disagrees.
Yeah.
Is that another way to say it?
I don't want to say it. So, yeah. So, that's right. So it's I would say, an issue. So that's an amusing idea. So just to give you an overall picture of the scales and numbers involved, you can ignore most of the numbers. I'll point out the interesting ones.
So in co-moving coordinates, we have a gigaparsec scale inhomogeneity in the matter density. So up here today, we have the matter density. It fluctuates on gigaparsec scales between an omega matter value of about 0.1 to 0.2 at the center, out to about 0.7 asymptotically, roughly speaking. Okay, so a big change over gigaparsec scales. So the co-moving distance to the CMB, to give you an idea, is about 13 or 14 gigaparsecs. The supernova data come out to about here. The Hubble radius today is about there. Okay, so it's a huge fluctuation that's required. So actually quite a conservative thing if you think about it in different ways. So the fine-tuning problem of these models, as with all cosmological models, is that we have to be quite close to the center. So analyzing the anisotropy in the CMB, the dipole in the CMB and the supernova, tells us that we need to be within, this is a paper by Blomqvist and Mürzel, tell us that we need to be within, say, tens of megaparsecs of the center. So compared to a void scale of gigaparsecs or a Hubble radius of about 4 gigaparsecs, this is quite a fine-tuning problem. Naively, one part in a billion, roughly, if you were plunked down at random in a Hubble volume, you would land up this close to the center. So that's an issue for them, which leads one to speculate that perhaps the Copernican and cosmological principles would have to be wrong for these models to work. So the Copernican principle just says that we're not at a special location in the universe. So these models seem to violate that. Just to remind ourselves about the coincidence problem that we have in cosmology, where we have a temporal coincidence, a temporal Copernican problem, if you like. We can also remind ourselves that Einstein introduced lambda, because of a misguiding temporal Copernican principle. He thought that we should not exist at a special place in time, whereas that seems to be incorrect. These models say that we have to live at a special place in space instead. Okay, so there's been some recent work on how we could test the Copernican principle directly. I'll just give you a flavor of the ideas quickly. Most of them involve looking along our past light, within our past light cone. All our observations in cosmology come from on our past light cone. There's a few that can come from off it. One is a neutrino background. Neutrinos don't travel quite at the speed of light, so they can come from within our past light cone to us. another idea by Goodman, and then more recently Caldwell and Stebbins, is to use the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect to try and measure the temperature of the CMB around distant observers and piece that together to give us an idea of what other observers see the CMB to be. And a variation on that by Garcia Bellido and that guy there use the KSZ effect, which measures gives an idea of the dipole of the CMB seen by distant observers. So they take those KSZ measurements. There's very few of them at the moment, but there will be quite a lot soon. And they show that within some of these void models, this is enough to rule them out, where the dipole can be quite large around distant observers. So this, I think, is a very nice test for the future, except that there's quite a lot of freedom in the model. So this is actually, I think, a free function in the more general model, but nevertheless a very nice potential way to study these issues. Yeah. Sorry?
David Garfinkel gave a talk earlier on similar on this idea.
Yes.
He was saying that this was quite a robust rolling
right.
Out of these voids.
Right. Well, yeah, so it is, but then when you put in radiation into the models, there's actually quite a lot more freedom because you've got a velocity potential between the matter and the radiation, which isn't constrained a priori. Okay, so this is so what we found when we did our CMB calculation, we found that the calculations done without including the radiation era properly were off by about 20% or so. So we found that the radiation is quite sizable, has a sizable effect. And also, trying to get a two-fluid inhomogeneous solution is actually quite complicated. And this velocity is just a naive estimate of what that would be. I'm not saying it's wrong, but I'm saying there's more general cases than this. Okay. So this assumes that the radiation is a test field set down in the early universe, whereas in fact it's a real field. Which needs to be taken into account, I think. But probably this is enough. This is enough with other observations to rule them out. This sort of thing. Well, that's the trouble. Yeah, once you move away from Friedman, there's quite a lot of freedom. Yeah. No. I'm not saying that. So, it's just, you know, this is one paper with 8 data points. So, you know, it's not. It's just a very nice way to look at it in the future, I think. Okay, so there's other ways we can do it with the going back to the sort of tests I introduced at the beginning, which is ways to test consistency of the standard model using observational data alone without assuming a model. So before I used omega m using derivatives of distance data. Now if we blend in some Hubble rate as a function of redshift data as well, one can then use this as a test of the Copernican principle. So in the Friedman models, the curvature parameter today is given by the relationship between the Hubble rate data and distance data as a function of redshift. If one calculates this at any redshift you like in a Friedman model, it will always give you the value of the curvature parameter today. And that's not true in general spacetimes, including in Tolman-Bondi universes. So this is another way to rule out these models from using observations on our past light cone,
rather than relying on observations from within it, which is potentially quite interesting. And it seems to be independent of all cosmological parameters, independent of dark energy model, or theory of gravity. Okay, so I'm going over time, but obviously it's useless at the moment, so the fluctuations are of order one, but that's because there's very few age data points in order to calculate H of Z. Okay, so just to finish off, I'd just like to think about, are these models completely ridiculous or not? So I think we'd all sort of feel very uncomfortable about the idea of living at the center of a Hubble scale inhomogeneity, which is spherically symmetric. So a coincidence of 1 part in 10 to the 9 is pretty unpalatable. Seemingly more unpalatable if it's in space rather than in time or within the standard model. One can perhaps think about whether there might be selection effects which could account for that. So, for example, let's say one can imagine that dark matter could perhaps inhibit solar system formation of, you know, our solar system has been stable for 5 billion years, 1/3 of the universe's evolution, which is actually quite a long time if you think about it. These models have very low dark matter density at the center. Could it be perhaps that something like this might happen, which would alter the selection of 1 part in 10 to the 9 in our Hubble volume? So it's possible that they aren't actually anti-Copernican when there's more information included, even though at first sight they look like it. How else could they fit together? Well, yeah.
Saying that we're the only solar system and...
No, but then you would expect then a higher density of observers towards the center, basically, rather than evenly scattered.
But we're supposed to be almost exactly in the center.
Well, it's tens of megaparsecs compared to a few gigaparsecs. So it's a factor of
100, 200, or 300 of the way out to the Hubble radius. So it's quite close, but it's not, you know, it's not bang on or anything.
In this first paper, I worked out the sense of the universe is in Virgo cluster. This was not a popular statement.
So that kind of statement would be difficult to believe. But anyway,
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think these are sort of worth investigating a bit further, even though they are a bit kind of strange. You know, one can imagine the universe is huge with these voids all over the place, and maybe, you know, a couple hundred years ago we didn't realize we lived in a galaxy, right? But maybe these are on super Hubble scales. Maybe these are scattered around all over the place. In which case, these types of models would be explaining the dark energy phenomena not in terms of something going on now, but something that happened early on during inflation. Something would happen 50 e-folds before the end of inflation that imprints this large scale in the universe, or something like that. I don't know. But the key conclusion of all this stuff is not really that these are good models of the universe, although I think they could be developed to accompany all observations, but the key conclusion is that dark energy is a consequence of our assumption of homogeneity, I think. So, yeah. Okay, so let me just run through. There's some open issues for voids, lots of things to calculate. Perturbation theory is a nightmare. Inflation is something that should be looked at, see if it could actually produce something like this. And one could argue that the Copernican principle might be able to be averted. So then you're left with a philosophical choice. If one could fit these to observations all the way, if one can do perturbation theory, a philosophical choice of dark energy or something wrong with slow roll inflation, which is quite an amusing possibility. Anyway, so just to conclude, the cosmological constant exists primarily by assumption, actually. And so I think model-independent consistency tests are going to be useful if one can think of ways to test the foundations of our cosmological model. And these might be a useful way to quantify our certainty of lambda independent of assuming parameterized models, which is ad hoc once one moves away from lambda, pretty much. Then there's this issue of back reaction, which is how we formulate the Friedman models in the first place. And there's a UV divergence in the in this when we calculate it in the Freeman models. Sorry, when we calculate this in perturbation theory to second order. Okay, so I'll stop there. Thank you.
Questions?
So, let me dispute the last statement that you have. But it seems to me that for every observable, you said there is a new function. So you have several functions.
Yeah.
So I still don't see quite how you can test this Copernican principle because.
Right.
Am I reading that right?
Yeah.
So how can you test that?
Right. Well, let's do this this curvature function. So, it's true if you measure basically if you measure h of z and d of z. But strictly speaking, there's another. If you want to be absolutely sure, you can measure the h of z in different directions.
Yeah. But then there's the velocity of the radiation fluid.
Right. So that's a separate.
And then there is the is
yeah. So that doesn't affect this. That's for the KSZ effect.
Yeah. Okay. So then, what is the test that could compare these two?
So that was a curvature test. Would directly compare these in a quantifiable way. So basically, I think we need to measure, as well as distance data, we need to measure Hubble rate data independently. And that will then be enough to...
this age rich redshift?
That's one way.
I see.
Because the supernova result you show us. Discrepancy.
Yeah, that's right. So for the simple model.
Stares you in the face.
Yeah. So I mean, I agree. Making up functions to fit, which get ever more absurd, is silly. But you know, if a Gaussian void doesn't do it or something similar, then I would say that these are probably becoming ridiculous. Yeah, more ridiculous. But nevertheless, kind of interesting, I think.
But when you say d of z, you mean that means luminosity observation?
Yeah. So any distance measure is a function of redshift. They're all the same basically. They're all related.
What are the other ones?
So you've got the luminosity distance, area distance, and those are the two main ones. But these are just related by a factor of redshift. And that's true in any space-time, they're just...
And you have some independent way of knowing the area?
So the area distance, for example, you can get through... Well, the CMB measures the area distance, say, whereas supernova measures the luminosity distance.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so the area... Oh, sorry.
If you were looking at supernova... Okay, so yeah. Supernova is just the...
Yeah.
The AS for the CMBS.
So whenever you measure the size of something, you compare it to your angular size, that gives you the area distance. Whenever you measure the brightness of something, you compare it to a standing candle, that gives you the luminosity distance.
Does anyone have any models why... You mentioned this, if there really is a void, it had to be caused by something earlier.
Well,
it might have been caused, that would be the most natural. Does anyone have any... idea of what might have caused such a void?
I don't know. No, I don't know. I think it would be fun to think of ways one could produce one. I think something happening about 50 odd e-folds before the end of inflation that imprints a large scale. So if inflation goes through a jump, that can imprint a scale. That kind of thing could do it.
Given that this void model can fit the data for work, all the data, the two models of the universe at present suffer from a violation of the Copernican principle. Let's not forget the man CDM does that. This, to me, is one of the most strangest problems in modern cosmology. Both models do one in time and one in space. And something very—it's very disturbing. It's very important.
But
there's no Copernican principle in time.
There's only a Copernican principle in time.
Time.
Right. There used to be.
Acceleration started doing its thing seriously when amoeba appeared on Earth.
Well, that's true.
I mean, come on. Isn't that weird?
Well, it's weird that lambda is so small without being zero.
It's so fitting using the lambda single data.
In cosmology, it's weird that lambda is so big, actually. Because if it was any bigger, life wouldn't exist at all. We'd be in the set of phases.
Putting in the data, it crosses in the sun was from the solar system.
Yeah, that's true, but it had to cross, if it was constant, which I don't believe it was, but if it was constant, it had to cross sometime. And so, I mean.
But the question is, why are you so close to that crossing?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting coincidence, and if you can explain it, that's more evident. It's a feather in the cap of your theory, right?
No, but in a,
like the fluctuating lambda, explain it.
In a lattice,
but if you don't explain it, it's not a disaster.
Look, in an F-I-coming
model, why is this fundamental?
In an F-I-coming model, there is no special place in time. Come on.
But there is.
No.
The Big Bang is a special place in time.
So this sounds like a good time.
Yeah.